Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee from London, UK. Now, welcome to the programme, sir. Now, since the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power in 2014, Indian Muslims have had to change the way they dress, eat and even speak in public. Now, how difficult is it to be a Muslim in India today?
It's not only difficult to be a Muslim in India today, it's also getting harder and harder to fight for equal treatment for Muslims as well. So in MPAC UK, we regularly host events where we invite speakers to talk about the situation in India, and activists tell us how it's just getting harder for them to stand up for Muslims' rights. They get singled out for punishment because they're known for criticising the current and historic Hindu supremacy in India. There was one event where one of our speakers, Sharjil Usmani, he couldn't even attend to speak because he was on the run from the police because of how he had worded one speech. That's the level of the absurdity of the scrutiny that Muslims face in India.
Mr. Hussain, BJP has moved to turn Mahatma Gandhi's secular India into a Hindu nation by othering the country's largest minority group. Now, do you think the appeasement of Hindus and the alienation of Muslims works as a political strategy?
Look at the 2002 Gujarat pogroms, when Muslims were vilified so thoroughly that the BJP governor only had to say a few words and the whole region erupted in arson and looting and rape. That governor was Modi, who continued his policy of appeasing one side and alienating the other, and he became prime minister. And India has erupted again and again in 2020 with the Delhi riots and the farmers' protests, because the issues of poverty and societal breakdown don't get resolved by scapegoating Muslims and Sikhs and other minorities. Any politician whose strategy it is to divide and conquer is a danger to their own country.
Mr. Hussain, Muslim bashing has become Modi government's unstated policy, which can be seen from statements of ministers and MPs. Now, do you think the absence of strong political opposition has emboldened the BJP government to tear apart the country's rich secular democratic ethos?
As with any bully, they are empowered every time they get away with their attacks. And I say this because I want your viewers to appreciate that you cannot understand modern India without understanding what India has been doing to Kashmir. Kashmir has been a guinea pig, a punching bag, a political football, no matter which party was running India. That's meant that no major party in India has the moral ground to stand up against BJP's ethno-nationalism, because they've all aided and abetted the same ideology in Kashmir. If we want to see a restrained BJP across India, then we have to see justice for Kashmir too.
Mr. Hussain, as we know, there is no legal ban on wearing religious dress in public places in India, but Muslim women wearing hijab still face backlash and discrimination. So why does this piece of cloth give so much jitters to the ruling elites in India?
That's because India's ruling BJP have no solutions for the people. They only have myths and symbols to try and placate their voter base. So they see something that looks like a symbol of Islam, the headscarf, and they zero in on it as a distraction for their voter base. But look, if the BJP were actually serious about women's rights, they would do something about the police force and their problem of kidnapping and then raping and then blackmailing women, which is something that many human rights organizations have written many times about.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, what does the future hold for Muslims in India, especially the younger generation? And do you see a silver lining in dark clouds?
I've mentioned the events that MPAC UK have done highlighting the oppression of Indian Muslims. So I've seen for myself that the young generation of activists, they have the brains to understand the root causes of their oppression. They have the spine to stand up for their freedoms. And honestly, their example is something that Muslims over here in the UK and Europe can learn from, alhamdulillah. But what they need more of, what every Muslim needs, is solidarity with the oppressed, with all oppressed people, because their pain is our pain, and their freedom one day will be our freedom too.
Mr. Hussain, thank you for being on the program once again.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's see how people have reacted on social media on the violence, harassment and persecution of Muslims.
Khalid Beijoun, a law professor and author, says, More Arabs and non-South Asian Muslims need to speak up on Hindutva terror in India, as Indian Muslims have always spoken up on Yemen, Palestine and Islamophobia in France. Senior Indian journalist Arfa Khanum Sharwani points to the difficulty of being a Muslim in today's India, urging the world to pay attention to the lives they are living under the Hindu nationalist BJP government. Ashok Swain, a Sweden-based Indian academic, refers to the closure of a mosque in Varanasi city to stress that Indian Muslims are struggling to survive under a majoritarian regime and highly partisan police force and judiciary.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In an interesting vote fast, India has banned the export of its wheat, partly due to the raging war in Ukraine and also the scorching heat wave curtailing output and pushing domestic prices to record highs. The populist move has been linked to the country's food security, as India, despite being the world's second largest producer of wheat, faces massive domestic food demand. This comes after India was initially eyeing as much as 12 million tons of wheat exports in 2022-23, significantly higher than last year's record exports of 7.2 million tons.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, during his talks with US President Joe Biden on April the 13th, said India was capable of feeding the world and filling the gap created by the Ukraine war. A month later, his government banned the export of wheat, shocking the world, including his own farmers. India, the second largest producer of wheat in the world, exported 8.2 million tons of wheat in the year leading to March 2022. The Modi government claimed that India could export anywhere between 10 and 15 million tons in the current fiscal year that ends March 2023. So far, less than 5 million tons have been contracted for exports, significantly less than the target. The move to ban exports is widely seen as part of a wave of protectionism sweeping the world in the backdrop of the Ukraine war. The knee-jerk decision came after the Indian government failed to buy enough wheat for its massive food security program, about 18 million tons, compared with nearly 44 million tons last year. That was largely due to high exports and relatively lower harvest as the scorching heat wave affected the yield. Rising food inflation also prompted New Delhi to reverse its decision.
India's ban on wheat exports has dealt a fresh blow to world markets at a time when the global buyers were banking on supplies from the world's second largest wheat producer. Low supplies from Canada, Europe and Australia and snarled supply lines in the war-torn Black Sea area have led to a rise in food prices, mostly hitting poor consumers in Asia and Africa. With the world's wealthiest countries denouncing New Delhi's knee-jerk decision, officials in India have pointed to the hypocrisy of the West, urging them to stop wasting food.
Although India is not one of the world's top wheat exporters, the ban is likely to push global food prices to new peaks, according to observers. Among those who have slammed the decision are the world's wealthiest countries. The move was denounced by agriculture ministers from the G7 industrialized nations, with German agriculture minister Cem Özdemir saying it would worsen the crisis. In response, Indian officials advised wealthy nations to stop wasting food and said New Delhi makes up less than 1% of global wheat exports. As per the UN Environment Programme, the US ranks 59 in terms of household food waste estimate per kilogram on capita every year. while Japan, Italy and Germany are at 64, 67 and 75 respectively, an Indian official was cited as saying. Some even pointed to the hypocrisy of G7 countries, recalling how the US, under the America First policy, banned the export of not just vaccines, but also raw materials required for their production in 2021. Among top destinations for Indian exports are Bangladesh, Indonesia, Nepal, and Turkey. And top global buyer Egypt also agreed recently to make a first-ever purchase of Indian wheat. Russia, Europe, US, and Canada are the top global wheat exporters, accounting for roughly 60% of world wheat exports.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Mushtaq Lashari, the founder and chairman of Third World Solidarity, based in London, UK. Welcome to the programme, sir. Now, Mr. Lashari, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi last month offered to help mitigate the global wheat deficit and, quote, feed the world. What has prompted New Delhi now to ban the export of this commodity?
I think, and we all know, what is the Narendra Modi's attitude toward the people of the world, whether it is human rights or whether it is related to food or anything. His main objective is to promote his populist Hindutva sort of policies. And he's doing it again. He wants to take, negotiate some sort of facilitation from the Western world, which will be affected. Because as you know, in third world countries or in developing world, these issues are not so relevant to the democracies. But wherever there is a democracy, if the prices go high, as it is going already high in United Kingdom, it is 9% inflation this year, while they can't increase the salaries of the people to 9%. So they are already facing a lot of unpopularity. And same is happening in USA. So what they will try to do is, while, as you say, there is a crisis going on because of the war in between Russia and Ukraine, or Ukraine fighting back Russia, there is already shortage of many commodities, including wheat, soya oil, and many. So the prices will jump. And because of the gas issues, there is a price hike in everywhere in the Europe, in Western world, in UK, because of that. And I think India and a few other countries who have some influence or some thing they can do with these prices by allowing the people to export, they will try to get their maximum benefits from these countries. But he wants to remain popular in the country, and that's why he's trying to do it. And I know that the peasants and farmers are not happy with it, because they want to get benefit of it. And if he carries on with this ban, they can't export. And if they can't export it, their prices in the country where they have a surplus wheat and other things, that will drop.
Mr. Lashari, as we know, India is the world's second largest producer of wheat after China. Now, does this decision hurt the credibility of the Modi government and convey a message that it does not have a credible export policy?
Definitely it will. Although the Western world has no choice, America, Britain and other countries, because at the moment their target is China. But I think still it will harm the standing and status of India in the world, which will definitely, in my opinion, affect Modi's credibility in the world. And if he loses the credibility, it is not easy to establish again your credibility. So it will definitely affect the Indian credibility and status in the world.
Mr. Lashari, India's move, along with dwindling supplies from Russia and Ukraine, have sent wheat prices soaring in the international market. What could be its possible repercussions?
I think that because Ukraine and Russia are already being excluded from the world by sanctions and other things which are sanctioned, basically, Ukraine is getting a lot of support, financial and military, but Russia is being excluded and isolated in the world at the moment by putting a lot of sanctions. Although it is very difficult to implement those sanctions, but India can be a next target if India continues it, and that will be very difficult to sustain for Indian economy.
Sir, do you think the scathing criticism from G7 industrialized nations over the decision to ban the export of wheat could prompt India to revise this decision?
I personally believe that Modi is very weak. He would not sustain if G7 continues the pressure on them to allow to export the wheat. I don't think Indian economy, politically, socially, and economically can sustain the pressure from the Western world or from G7.
Last but not least, sir, how does this populist move affect farmers and traders in India who are apparently not happy?
Oh, basically, they are the people who elected Modi. He has been twice elected with a majority or popular vote. And if it economically affect the people of India, his popularity will go down. And he's already being criticized by the world or G7 and others by not looking after the minorities. This will be another issue which will affect him. But in my opinion, Modi might resist it because he knows that he's old. This is his last term, in my opinion. You never know, because in our part of the world, there is no restriction of continuing for third and fourth and fifth term. But I think he will definitely look at it, and it is possible that he will take a U-turn.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Lashari for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people think of India's ban on wheat exports amid global food crisis.
Former Indian diplomat M.K. Bhadrakumar slams Western pundits for criticizing India's decision to ban the export of wheat, arguing that all countries give primacy to the welfare of their own citizens. Minhas Merchant, a senior journalist and author, calls India's reaction to the criticism of G7 countries as tight slap, saying the industrialized nations ignore the fact that the move aims to ensure India's food security. Former Indian military officer Brigadier Mahalingam, responding to the statement by German agriculture minister over India's ban on wheat exports, urges him to ask the US to lift sanctions to allow free flow of commodities.
And that was our episode about the BJP government's anti-Muslim policies in India and New Delhi's move to ban the export of wheat. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
نقشه دوم شیطان فساد جنسیه.
After financial corruption, the Satan is after creating sexual corruption in a society. One manifestation of sexual corruption is the birth of children out of illegitimate wedlock. Also, we have in our narrations, especially in a hadith by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, that he says, the killers of prophets and the assassinators of the offspring of the prophets are those who were born illegitimately through adultery.
شما در کربلا ببینید امثال عبیدالله ابن زیاد و امثال یزید و اینا.
When you look at the events of Karbala, you find such a case too. People like Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad and Yazid ibn Muawiyah were among such people. The late Sayyid ibn Tawus, in his book Luhuf, believes that those 10 people who galloped with their horses on the body of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam in the scene of Karbala were all illegitimate children of their parents. Therefore, one of the main plans of the Satan to deceive people is encouraging them toward haram children and illegal and illegitimate sexual relations beside financial corruption. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Laurie Calhoun Ryder. This article is published under the heading America's Exceptional Amnesia. Here's the story. Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Yet Americans are often hesitant to apply the label war criminal even to figures such as George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, whose global so-called war on terror has sowed massive destruction, death, and misery, adversely affecting millions of persons for more than 20 years. Nor do people generally regard affable Barack Obama as a war criminal, despite the considerable harm to civilians unleashed by his ill-advised war on Libya. Drone warrior Obama also undertook a concerted campaign to kill rather than capture terrorist suspects in countries such as Pakistan, with which the United States was not at war, and he armed radical rebel forces in Syria, which exacerbated the conflict already underway, resulting in the death of even more civilians. Obama's material and logistical support for the Saudi war against Yemen gave rise to a full-fledged humanitarian crisis, with disease and starvation ravaging the population. Moving a bit farther back in time, U.S. citizens and their sympathizers abroad typically do not affix the label war criminal to Bill Clinton either, despite the fact that his 1999 bombing of Kosovo appears to have been motivated in part to distract attention from his domestic scandal at the time. The moment Clinton began dropping bombs on Kosovo, the press, in a show of patriotic solidarity, abruptly switched its attention from the notorious blue dress to the war in progress. Throughout his presidency, Clinton not only bombed, but also imposed severe sanctions on Iraq, as a result of which hundreds of thousands of civilians died of preventable diseases. Despite knowing about at least some of the atrocities committed in their name by the U.S. government, including torture, summary execution, maiming, the provision of weapons to murderers, sanctions, preventing access to medication and food, etc., many Americans have no difficulty identifying other world leaders as a war criminal, while simultaneously withholding that label from their own leaders. Viewed from a broader historical perspective, none of this may seem new. During wartime, much of the populace dutifully parrots pundits and politicians in denouncing the foreign leaders with whom they disagree as criminals, while supporting the military initiatives of their own leaders, no matter what they do. In the use of the term of derogation war criminal, then, no more than a reflection of the tribe to which one subscribes. All wars result in avoidable harms to innocent, non-threatening people, death and maiming, the destruction of property, impoverishment, psychological trauma, and diminished quality of life for those lucky enough to survive. Given these harsh realities, Some critics maintain that all war is immoral. But morality and legality are not one and the same, for crimes violate written laws. We know that the U.S. 2003 invasion of Iraq was illegal according to the letter of the law, not only because former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan plainly stated that it was, but also because the U.S. government drafted a war resolution only to withdraw it when it emerged that they did not have enough support to secure the needed U.N. approval. If U.S. leaders had believed that the invasion was completely legitimate according to the terms of the U.N. Charter, then they would have felt no need to draft a resolution in justifying it. Ex post facto, when it emerged that the alleged WMD serving as one of the primary pretexts for the war were nowhere to be found, the U.S. government claimed that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was simply a continuation of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, which had received the support of the United Nations, or was justified because Saddam Hussein allegedly tried to assassinate George H.W. Bush in 1993, or because previous UN resolutions relating to the disarmament of Iraq and the elimination of its biological and chemical warfare capacity implied that military force would be permissible in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-compliance. On the propaganda front, the U.S. administration also pumped through the media pretexts, such as that the people of Iraq needed to be liberated from their ruthless dictator, and it was high time to allow democracy to flourish throughout the land. People have been writing about war crimes for millennia, long before the establishment of the United Nations and the ICC, International Criminal Court. The framework proffered in 1945 UN Charter derives from the classical just war tradition. By definition, a war criminal is someone who commits war crimes. But according to just war theory, there are two ways to become an unjust warrior. One is to wage an unjust war. The other is to conduct a war unjustly. These two forms of injustice are outlined in the Jew ad bellum and Jew in bello requirements on a just war, the interpretive fluidity of which has often been seized upon by political leaders intent on waging war. Such leaders use just war theory opportunistically as a template in developing pro-war propaganda. The aim of the drafters of the UN Charter was to rein in such bellicose tendencies and thereby avert tragic and massively destructive conflicts such as the First and Second World Wars by requiring explicit and intersubjective agreement among nations before a war could be waged. Deception is a form of coercion, which implies that a leader who offers false pretexts to secure the approval of the UN Security Council, as did George H.W. Bush in 1991, is no less a criminal than a leader whose war objectively violates the written letter of the law, as in the case of his son, George W. Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. Indeed, in predicting how leaders will conduct themselves during the prosecution of war, there may be no dependable indicator than how they went about garnering support for it. By now, it is common knowledge that all of the proffered pretexts for the 2003 invasion of Iraq were bogus, from the non-existent WMDs to the alleged collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Given the many lies used to persuade politicians and pundits to support the invasion, no one should have been surprised when those who waged a criminal war proceeded to render and torture suspects, kill civilians at checkpoints, deploy white phosphorus and depleted uranium-tipped missiles, raise entire cities, and terrorize civilians with lethal drones. Biden's debilitated mental state and inability to keep his story straight is the perfect metaphor for the attitude of Americans toward war criminals. They blithely ignore or brush aside the crimes committed by their own leaders, while supporting policies which will intensify rather than resolve conflicts abroad.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Najafi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
How are you?
Alhamdulillah.
So glad to be with you. Thank you so much for coming.
It's more than pleasure for me.
Thank you so much, Sister. Sister, today I'm going to discuss something that is tremendously changing our lives, that is changing our lives so fast, especially the mindset, the lifestyle, and that is social media. Social media apps are designed in a way that you become addictive and you are forced to change your mindset, your lifestyle, your trends, whatever you are doing. It has impact on your health, on the way you think, to the way you do things. So we also have a question in this regard. We'll hear to that. It is Nasser Ali Khan from Srinagar.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Nasser Ali Khan and I'm from Srinagar, Kashmir. I work as a social activist and I have seen a drastic change since the time social media has been introduced in our society. I have seen our younger ones, our youth, following different various negative paths as far as social media is considered. And this brings a very huge gap when it comes to sharing and taking responsibility of our society, when it comes to our religious upbringing. So I just wanted to ask one question, that how will we explain it to our younger ones that the proper religious upbringing is the one which will not only groom their lives, but will also give them a direction towards a better life, towards a better future?
Well, sister, how do you answer that question? The question is almost, I'll just sum it up. Social media is playing a tremendous role, and in that way, it is affecting the mindset of the young generation. And he, as a social activist, feels that there is a need to change this mindset. There's a need to make them understand that religious way is one of the better ways to groom you. So what do you say on that note?
I know it's not an easy answer to give. You know, the answer is very difficult practically, because easy to say, but in practice, we have to be very, very, very careful. First of all, we as a parents, we have to show that this religion, deen, yeah, the lifestyle which Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala has given to us, that religion can be a best solution of our needs.
Yeah.
If I'm enjoying the rulings of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, obeying of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, and I have to say to my child in detail, because in this era, in this time, because they are getting all the information in a very colorful, very glamorous, very beautiful, very easy, very in detail way. And we tell them about religion totally in opposite way, black and white, you know, and
in a big picture,
yeah, dull. And just one point.
Boring.
Exactly. So how it can work? You know, it cannot be work if, you know, the we can say the comparison between the bombardment of social media and the way we are guiding our children towards Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala and beautiful religion of Allah is not, unfortunately, comparable. So first of all, which I have seen in my family and my like society, that, you know, we have beautiful role models, mashallah. They are teens, they are youngsters, they are using, maybe we can say 99% of social media in a very positive way. So I truly recommend that not only we should bring Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam only, or ashab or companions as a role model, all some ayatullah and you know, great experts as a role model to them. No, that is not enough. That should be there, definitely. But they need someone from their society,
you know,
alive, updated role model. If they see, wow, you know, she lives in my country, for example, and she goes the same uni where I go, you know, something like the same challenges we have. Mm-hmm. But look at her, how positively she is using her social media, and religion has given her so much power. You know, look at the beauty she or he has because of religion. Look at the comfort, you know, she has because of, or he has because of the religion.
So, all right.
Yeah.
So first of all, you said like you made a comparison between the two things, that what wrong information is going being fed to us in a glamorous way. It is you said there's a media bombardment, there's a social media bombardment of this wrong information. And at the same time, we are not guiding, we are not providing religious information in a very, you know, some classy way. We are just making it boring and dull. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you. Here we need to take a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Sister Najafi, and we are discussing the impact of social media on the upbringing. Sister Najafi, you said that we as parents do not feed the religious information to our children in a very classy or trendy or glamorous way. We make it boring. We make it dull. We make them feel lazy and they feel like, I'm done with this. What can parents do to guide their children to take them out of this trend of social media kind of things, wherein you said the things are being fed in a way they should not be? You said that wrong information is actually being fed. You said old things are being told to them, but in a glamorous way.
Yeah.
What can we do to feed them religious things in a beautiful way?
They have to, first of all, they have to stop verbally, you know, giving all the lectures and advices the way we do. Unfortunately, the very common way of teaching Islam and Deen in our families, which is very norm, we have to stop. Yeah, we have to very limit it, make it limited. And number two, I have seen many of our youngsters, especially in Western countries, they get change very easily. They can come towards the deen very easily by having some summer camps, some retreats, you know, spiritual retreats. And when they come for ziyarah trips, that gives them a big, you know, U-turn in their life.
All right.
Yeah. And many, many parents, they came to me and they said, you know, we were failed in upbringing of our children, but because of this trip, because
like
again,
Irvine trip.
Yeah. The trip gives them, again, the beautiful society and
yeah.
company. The company means a lot. And then they get some role models. They say, wow, for example, I'm from this country. And look at them. First time he's or she's meeting them.
Right.
And they all are faithful. You know,
yeah.
they have that love for Imam Hussein or Aima alayhi salam. And then, unfortunately, our study and our information about hero, teens, like the way our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has chosen, animated some teen heroes as a governor. For example, I'll give you the name of Amr bin Hamqi Khaza'i. He was nominated by Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, yeah, as a governor of Yemen. And Mus'ab bin Umair, he was a young, handsome, trendy youth, a young person, a companion of Rasulullah. And Prophet has nominated him as a first representative of him towards the city of Medina. So we have list of teens, yeah, and they were in teens or early 20s, and look at their challenges in their life. So we don't talk about those kind of
yeah,
amazing
we hardly
role
know about these personalities.
Yeah. And
so
one more about Nawab-e Arba'a, like four ambassadors of Imam-e Zamana. If we have time, we will talk about them.
Yes, we'll talk about that, but after a short
yeah.
break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, O nation of Shia, teach your children the poems of Al-Abdi, because he was a follower of the religion of Allah.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. And Sister Najafi, you were talking about the role models that we hardly know about.
I really want to mention about the four ambassadors of our present Imam, our final Imam, Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. You know why? Because we can just connect with them nowadays, in this era.
In the contemporary world.
Yeah. Why? Because we can connect with our present Imam, first of all. And we know that they used to live, although in minor occultation, we are in the major occultation. And the challenges the ambassadors of Imam, they had in their time, sometimes You know, that would be a very beautiful role model for us. We can just learn so many lessons from them.
Right.
And I think it would be something really nice because we need holy personalities and some real updated nowadays role models, some youngsters who live in our era, in our time. So combination of role models, yeah, you can say, look at this, for example, I will give you the name of Hussein bin Ruh. For example, you know, and unfortunately, mostly we don't know about their amazing and very fascinating history of life. And Muhammad bin Usman, Ali bin Samari, Ibn Sa'id Amari. So their challenges were, for example, they were a normal people, like they would have some business in the society, in bazaar, in market. And look at them, you know, although they are, for example, studying in uni or having some business, but while having that business, how they were helpful to Imam of their time. And the techniques are so amazing. I don't remember everything in detail, but some of the instances, for example, one of the ambassador, he used to do the business of oil. Yeah, he used to sell out the oil or maybe perfumes. So he would put some the letters of Imam inside the bottles. He would hide it because the circumstances are very, yeah, very, very intention. Yeah. And sometimes in the wood cutters, you know, they would put some letters inside the sticks and wood, you know, so that the techniques are, you know, the boys, the girls, they love it because I have done this kind of work, if some workshops with our teenagers, they love it. Yeah. Because these are something, you know, challenges are there and full of, we can say, excitement, and you can teach them some techniques that how you can spread out your beautiful religion and practice your religion, even in a very, very crucial time.
Exactly. So when we are practicing that, as you said, practically doing those activities physically today, and we realize that toughness, how tough it is to send an information inside an oil packed, inside a perfume packed, and then we can realize the knowledge, the tremendous knowledge we have today
about
Islam.
Yeah.
We will be really thankful. We will actually take it as a blessing. That's how we will take it as a blessing that imams have not, you know, done less, and they have not gone through some very easy paths. This
exactly.
knowledge that we have,
yeah.
this treasure actually that we have right. today has not come that easy to us. It has come through very difficult levels. And when we are practicing that practically,
yeah, then we appreciate more. Definitely.
We appreciate, we realize that it is a blessing. It is a treasure.
Indeed, indeed.
Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.